Excited to welcome Concordia St. Paul head coach Matt Fletcher to the basketball podcast. Coach Fletcher enters his sixth season as head men's basketball coach at Concordia St. Paul in 2025-26, where he's quickly become the program's most successful leader. Culminating in the 2024-25 season, he guided the Golden Bears to their first ever NSIC regular season title, first NCAA Division II tournament appearance, and first NCAA tournament win, all in the same year, earning him the 2024-25 NSIC Coach of the Year honor. Prior to Concordia, Fletcher spent four highly successful seasons as head coach at Bethany Lutheran College, where he compiled a 76-33 record, won the 2017-18 UMAC Coach of the Year Award, and led the team to two NCAA Division II tournament appearances. His overall career head coaching record stands at 120-118 across 9 seasons. Fletcher's extensive assistant coaching experience includes stints at Concordia Moorhead, Kentucky Wesleyan, and 3 years at Upper Iowa University.
Do you know which lineups and player combinations are the most productive? Hoopsalytics has the most comprehensive lineup analysis system available. Coaches can see how each group performs offensively or defensively or excels in special situations. For example, if you need to force a late-game turnover, you can see which group has the best defensive turnover percentage or see which four athletes work best with your star player. And you can do the same team-based analysis for groups of two or three players as well. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com today to learn more.
Coach Fletcher, welcome to the basketball podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be on.
Awesome to have you here. And Concordia St. Paul, you've had some success there building it and getting it to a few first evers. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we got the job during COVID, which was interesting to say the least. You're moving your family. My first 2 months on the job, I couldn't go in the office, which is weird. But we ended up getting it going and took a couple of years. We took a ton of freshmen early and let them grow into it. We had the learning curve, obviously, playing young guys. You lose a lot of close games, but we stuck with it. And I think a couple of years ago, we would have been pretty dang good, but we got hit with the injury bug. But this last year, we turned the corner. We had some really good players, some seniors that had been through it and knew what to expect. And we were able to win a lot of close games and find a way to steal one of the better leagues in the country. So it was a lot of fun, and it's been a great situation so far, and we love being here.
We're going to talk about a whole bunch of things, but clearly offense is at the top of the mind for both of us, and that's how we connected a little bit over offense. And coaches, we're going to provide a YouTube video with this podcast as well, so you can dive into the concepts a little bit deeper that coach is going to share. But let's start with the pace concept of 3 to 4 second shot clock rule.
Yeah, it's something that we've really evolved. I think one of the biggest things people do when they try to play faster, we play a little bit more unique style than a lot of Division II teams do. Not saying that's right or wrong. It's just my passion, the way I like to do it. Anytime you play fast, I think it gets mistaken that you shoot fast. For us, we try to eliminate that thought by, you know, how fast you get the ball out of bounds, how fast you fill deep corners, how fast you get into your initial, whatever your concept is, your action, if you have triggers or you play out a ball screen or whatever you do. So we actually implemented putting a 3 or a 4 second shot clock up. And that, when that buzzes, so every possession when we play live, that buzz will happen. And that's when we need the deep corners filled. That's when we need NBA wings filled. And then we need to be in our first action. We need to be in our first, whatever we're calling, whatever we're in at that moment. That's just triggering how fast we need to get into those spots. And then we actually don't play with a shot clock after that. And I think I can think of one hand, maybe how many times the shot clock's gotten even below 10 when we play. It's just something that we've implemented to make them understand it's not about how fast we shoot it. It's how fast we move, make decisions, run the court, get the ball out, those types of things. And that's how we've emerged playing fast, quote unquote, which a lot of coaches like to say and do. And it's something that we changed to change shot selection and better decisions and limiting turnovers and stuff like that.
Great stuff. You mentioned a unique approach relative to Division II. Can you shape that a little bit more for us?
Yeah, I'd say, I think one of the main things is Division II coaches, guys don't leave. I'm playing and coaching against coaches right now that I played against in 2008. There's guys that are in this league that have been doing away and have had tons of success. So they're going to stick to their guns and what they do really well. And so you see a lot more different styles. And one like mine just isn't very prevalent in the Division II game with the up and down pace. More actions or motion based or sets. Some do sets. Some have continuity motions, continuity ball screens. And again, they've won at crazy high level. So those work as well too. It's just a different style. And I knew when I got in the league that I wasn't going to beat some of these guys that have been doing it for 20 years. So I had to bring my own unique twist to get kids interested in being here and wanting to play here. And that was my idea. And I was a 3-point shooter in college, so I wanted to build an offense that fit, my personality and my likes of the game. So that was the focus going into it.
That makes sense. And you mentioned shot clock and the importance of educating them about that. So talk to us about how you do that. What is the process for educating them about the shot clock?
I think the biggest thing when you play fast is kids think, and they immediately think when you play fast that you got to shoot it fast. First shot we got to take, or whoever has the ball when you cross half court, you come off a ball screen, that guy's shooting it, shooting a step back or hitting the roll man, and that guy's got to score. And so we focus a ton on shot selection and how that changes. That should make the ball move naturally. I think every kid that comes into college has something that they're good or great at when they come in. Some great players have a bunch, but most kids come in and they have an attribute that's really good. And so we make them hunt that action. We make them hunt what they do best and turn down other things. Well, then naturally the ball moves. Our decisions are faster and more crisp because if it's not what you're really good at, naturally you just move the ball, you get rid of it. And so we found a lot of success with that, with the ball playing kind of being, it doesn't get sticky. Guys don't hold on to it because if, let's say I'm a shooter and I catch it, and I don't have a shot, I'm immediately moving it or immediately putting it on the deck. So a lot of stampede type catches. We're trying to eliminate thinking and catching holds. And with that, we've just seen the shot clock never really becomes a factor. So when we play defense, we use the shot clock. When we play offense, it's that 3 second one. So polar opposites. We want to try to make you work to score, and then we want to make it seem effortless is the goal of the system.
Yeah, it confirms that basketball is a game of opposites a lot of times, and that's a great
Yeah,
example of
exactly.
that. So coaching shot selection, with that, you talked about a little bit of the spacing, corners, and you called it the NBA wing. So talk to us about connecting those things together. Early in the shot clock, if we've got a good shot, we're okay with it. If not, what are we flowing? How are we flowing from there?
Yeah, so we'll call it an initial trigger, initial action based on where the ball is, what system are we in with the bigs. Sometimes we do a trail ball screen. Sometimes they're down in the dunker and we do guard to guard action. Sometimes we do handoffs into ball screens, all whatever you have called. And then if we don't get anything on the initial action, the goal of the initial action isn't necessarily to score for us, it's to get an advantage. We want to get the advantage and we want to keep it. And one of the main things we talk about filling the deep corner is it just creates space, as much space as possible. And I think too many times teams, especially when I see high school, they lift out of those corners and it condenses. Just the simple space of a guy to drive or even attack a little bit of gap. But if you play a good defensive team, which that is where I think Division II thrives, is teams can guard like crazy. And if you're going to play a pack line defense and you're going to shorten those pack line gaps for them, you're going to make your life very difficult. As simple as having spots on the court where guys need to hunt, that created space for us. And then a little bit of predictability on knowing when your teammates are where they're going to be when you do attack. Because if you don't run a set, there is randomness to it, right? And so we want to make sure they understand, okay, if I drive baseline, where are my teammates going to be? And then what's my read? If I drive middle, where are my teammates going to be? And what's my read? And then we try to drill those like crazy and then have the guys on the wings and the corners play off of the drive. And then everything we study is about when the help moves, what do we do? When they go, when the gap goes, when the help and recover goes, when the baseline fill and sink goes, what do we do? And that's where, if you're in the corner, you're in that NBA wing, you're already in the spot you need to be. So, one, you're shot ready. And two, then you can react to the defense. Whereas if you're still moving or not in the correct spot and then the help goes, now all of a sudden you're having to readjust where you are before you get into a cut or a shape or whatever it is that your trigger is. And we want to make sure that they're in those spots so they can react faster. For example, if you drive baseline, fill and sink happens, the 45 cut's there, and you can cut down the middle of the paint. If you're not in the right spot, that 45 cut's not going to be there because you're moving to your spot first and then 45 cutting, or you're too low or too high and you're running into a help defender. So that's where our emphasis, we tape those on the court for the entire preseason and we show it on film. See if you're 2 feet up this far, this is what happens. Just those little tiny things to make them, and you got to make them understand how important it is. They have to understand just the, because kids don't want to stand in the corner. You tell a kid, hey, I need you to run and stand in the deep corner until someone kicks you out. It's not the most fun job. So making sure kids understand the importance of it and then how they can have success with it too. And that was a big focus for us with this group that we have this year.
I can say I'm aligned with that, especially coaching younger kids and just having them hold a
Yeah.
corner. Because you think about
Yep.
penetration reaction, whether you push pull or you drive left, you move left, whatever it is, you always hold the corner until you
Always.
have a
Yep.
decision, basically, right? That's what you're saying.
Yep. Yeah. So just a simple one. If a guy drives opposite baseline and he has to, and the help comes, you need to be in the corner in case you're the kick out for the shot. We talk about if a guy drives middle from the baseline, you have the option for that back cut if the help steps up at all, or a step up for the catch. But if you're in the deep corner first, you're staying in the vision of the driver. So anytime a driver comes from the wing, the top, the slots, wherever it is up top, if he drives, the longer you're in that deep corner, the longer you're in that player's vision. The second you lift, you're now decreasing the vision and the passing angle. So that's one thing that I think this group has really grasped well this year is when I drive, the further down the court I am in the corners, he can see me longer. That gives you a better opportunity to receive the pass or a cut or whatever you're going to do. Just another simple teaching point for kids that if, you know, someone goes behind you, can you see them? There's a few kids, maybe one per team that can make those difficult, high difficulty passes. Let's try to avoid tailoring to those one kids and maybe to the rest of the drivers and passers. So we try to make sure that they can see their teammates and understand where they're going to be, and fill in that deep corner keeps you in vision the longest. So same as the dunker spot with the big.
Love it. Simplifies the process and creates better spacing overall. And you mentioned obviously shot selection and making these decisions. So one of the things you use is green, yellow, red shot system. So talk to us about what that means for your program.
So this has been an ongoing evolving, I think coaches say it a lot, and I'm sure you've heard it with all the guests you've had. And one of my favorite things about your podcast is all the different people that come on with all their different systems, and they've all had success. So there's no right way to coach it. There's no wrong way. It's finding your niche on how you can coach, because shot selection is a unique thing to try to get kids to understand, because you're trying to tell a kid that I'm not saying you can't make the shot. I'm just saying it's not the best shot for us. And trying to get them to understand that. So we do a lot of analytics. I know that's a new thing, but we dummy it down to about as dumb a level as you can get. Basically, a green shot for us is an open shot. I'm not anti mid-range. A lot of people that say they do analytics and play fast, they just assume it's anti mid-range. We're not anti mid-range. We're anti contested. That's it. And what we find, obviously, based on analytics, the contested shot usually is most in the mid-range, because it's when a defender cuts you off and a guy results to a pull-up or a step back. It equals a contested shot. We basically just create green looks based on the team. And why we like the way we do it is because it can tailor to our group. It doesn't have to be the same. If you have a team full of three-point shooters, guys that can cast it, well, your green light three-point shots might look different than if you have a team that's a little bit more tailored to get into the cup. You might have a guy that his green shot at the rim is different than the next player. So we tailor to every player on what their green light shots are, and then they hunt those. So then the ball moves. It's the roundabout way to say it. But so for an example, if you're a shooter and I'm a driver, and your green light shot is a perimeter pass, NBA range three, that might be yellow for me, meaning later shot clock. If you're shooting it, it's wide open type of thing. But if I drive to the rim in the my defender's on my hip and I can go score, that might be different than you if you're a driver and you're not great at finishing at the rim. And making them understand that if you're taking a yellow, you're taking away my green or somebody else's green, and trying to get them to really understand that if you're a driver, yes, you should get to the rim and score, but if the help comes, you're getting one of our green guys, a shooter, a green look on the perimeter as well. And really trying to get them to tailor to that and understand the connection between it. And red for us is just contested. And I think the most difficult part was you have to learn to coach your best player through green, yellow, and red. You got to be able to coach your best guy that shoots the most shots. What's a good shot for him? And then you make the other players understand too. If you're the best player, you probably have more green than other players. You might come in as a freshman and have one green thing. You're a sniper. You can shoot open threes, and until your game evolves and you get stronger, that might be your green. By the time you see an all-league player of the year like we had last year, he had quite a few options that he could do, and guys can understand that. But as long as you're being transparent with everybody, green, yellow, and red, and communicating that, I think that's how we found success with it. And so yellow for us is an open one. Perimeter pass, usually three, is a yellow for us, which if it's wide open, we'll take those. If you're on the hip of your primary defender and you get all the way to the charge circle, we'll leave that. as a yellow. Green, we want to get past him. Red would be if the secondary defender comes and helps. Those types of things where it's levels of contest pretty much are the three levels. Green's wide open, yellow's maybe, and then red is no thanks. We'll move on.
Love it. I love the phrasing. Obviously, you take a bad shot, that takes away a good shot from someone else on your team. And also connecting it to the fact that if you take a good shot, you're more likely to be successful. And so
exactly.
are we.
Yep. And you're not trying to put kids early on. You'll have kids, oh, you're putting me in a box. You're trying to, I can do so much more than this. And I'm not, I always say, I'm not saying you can't do that. I'm just saying until you earn your green light for the first 3 weeks of practice, we don't say a thing. I don't say a thing about shot selection. I don't say a thing about where we're shooting it from, who's shooting it. I just let the stats analyze itself, figure out where guys are really good, and then we hone in on trying to get guys into spots, get them into their areas where they're going to help our team win games, and then help them understand that. And then at the end of the day, for college level, we can recruit kids that are going to fit that mold. Selfless, they want to win, that's all they care about, willing to make the extra pass, the plus ones, the easy ones. That's obviously something you can tailor to. For high school kids, I think anytime you can give a kid a role that maybe isn't a basketball player year round, let them be great at something, they're going to thrive in those different things. And that's when I've seen high school coaches that I think is the most difficult, because you have a different team every year and your best player might do something different every year. It might be a point guard, it might be a five, it could rotate. And so high school coaches that can coach it the best, I think that's the most fascinating part for me.
Yeah, great point there. And a good way, you've already mentioned triggers a little bit, but maybe help us understand a little bit more. What are some preferred triggers? And do you have different triggers, like say miss shot, made shot, turnovers, et cetera?
Yeah, so the way I've developed it was where the ball goes on the court is the initial trigger. So if we bring up the right side, the right slot, the right wing, there's action one. So that's the first part. Then the second part is wherever the guards run to, you never cross the midline. So if we have an overload side, so you have three guards run to the left while the ball's coming up the right, that automatically creates a trigger based on having an overload and what the big will do. If all of a sudden we have an overload to the ball side, so you have a corner filled, a wing filled, and the ball's coming up that side, that creates another trigger. If the ball comes up the center of the court, that creates another trigger based on the screening angle, what we do with the big. Do we have cuts coming from certain spots? Do we have flare screens coming from certain spots? What are we doing to manipulate the checks and the helps? All happening within about a 3 or 4 second window. So our goal is the defense sprints down so they feel like they're in transition defense at all times, make or miss. That's the initial goal. Then as soon as that action happens, based on where you ran the court, we don't have to call anything. It changes the trigger. So the first couple of weeks are just memorization. Just if we're in this situation, here's what we're playing. This is the set we're running. Not really a set, but it's the type of screen. Is it a pick and pop? Is it a pick and roll? Is it a handoff into a ball screen? Is it a skip pass into a grenade action? Is it a, based on where guys run down the court, creates the trigger pretty much. And so when we took the thinking out of it and me having to yell anything, that sped us up even more because guys just understood, like, okay, if I run here, the ball's there, this is what we're running. And then I can obviously add, we change a lot of things with the screening angle, the big, we do a lot of guard to guard screening. We call them bump tap hits, which are screen and roll, pick and pop, and go screen. And we mix in those and we chart to view. So let's say you're a shooter. And so we look at you and you say, okay, you're setting guard to guard screens, but right now you're screening and rolling 70% of the time. You're a shooter. We need you doing that about 70% popping and 30% rolling just to keep them honest type of thing. And those things happen based on a trigger too. So a basic trigger for you would be if the ball gets kicked ahead opposite wing. So if the ball is bringing up the right side, it gets skipped across to the left side. He has two options. He can get into a Barkley action if he likes his matchup, or initially turns around, goes right into a grenade action with the trailing guard. Then he chooses, as that grenade action happens, whether he's bump, tap, or hitting, which is pick and pop, pick and roll, or tap screen. And this all just happens on the fly, and you're trying to keep that defender occupied. And then on the backside, we'll either have a cut or a flare screen, or a baseline cut based on who is where, based on position, and just happens that fast. So then the best part about it is the next trip down, me and you might be in switch spots. So the play for the defense feels different, but it's the exact same for us. But maybe I'm a shooter, so I'm going to tap screen all the time. You might be a driver, so you're going to screen and roll every time. And all of a sudden, this is just happening on the fly. Then you can maybe catch a tag, not quite as checked across the paint to help because last time it was a pick and pop, and now this time it's a screen and roll, that type of thing. And just creating like a, you're always in attack. We're always in attack mode. Again, doesn't mean we shoot it fast. Our goal is we take the first green shot we can, whether that's one pass, no pass, or 20 seconds of action, then we just keep hunting green. And when we practice, we score only green shots. So if you make a yellow or a red, sorry, you don't get the point for it. So it's a running joke. The guys laugh about it and they get it now, but at the same time, they understand it. So it's a simple way to really hammer home. That's a good one, but we can get better type of thing.
Bump, tap, hit. That's great phrasing. Yeah.
Yeah, bump, tap, hit. So as they're running up, they got to yell it out which one they're doing so the guard knows. And then we just rely on the guards on the other team just not being able to react that
So
fast.
they're actively calling that.
Yes. Yep. They have to communicate it as they come up to the screen. So then the guard knows, is he rolling, popping, go screening? And then certain guys, like we have a guard that likes to post. He's going to hit a lot because he wants to switch. He wants to get the other guard on him so then he can get down in the post. Then we have another guy that's just a knockdown shooter. He's going to tap screen a lot and hope you guys screw up the switch so he can get the open look type of thing. And then we chart it individually with guys like, and make them understand, well, you need, this has got to be a situation where you go screen it. This has got to be a situation where you pick and pop so you get that matchup type of thing. And we really try to do a lot of individual film with guys so we can put them in a position where they have success, which then gives us success type of thing.
I love it and great phrasing. And watching some of the clips that you shared with me, I can see that in action as well. The other thing I saw in action is, and I want to talk about this a little bit deeper, is the ability of the point guard to be able to drive until they're stopped. We've had it phrased on the podcast before. Carly Thibault said, Gus, go until you're stopped. So I noticed that on your film. So talk to us about that.
So anytime the guard can get a probe situation, some people call, there's different names for it, but get that guard defender on his back, keep it. And basically you're holding the checks, you're holding all the help as long as you possibly can. And that's giving you passing angles. So the point guard's first roll when he comes off, whoever it is coming off the screen and you're looking to score. If you don't come down to score, you're not helping us out. So playing with that type of pace and attack mode to it. Second option is the big, because if you're taken away, odds are the big is the second option. And if the big's taken away, then your decision should be pretty simple. And we really work on those reads for those guards. And where I think Antoine last year had such a great success was he could get the hip of that guard and keep that guard on his back for a long time. He was so strong that the guard to fight back to full strength. Sometimes the check would come in, the show would happen, and they'd all go away, and he'd still be probing and all of a sudden get a clear path to the rim. And so keeping the defender on you as long as you possibly can, the big keeping space, we don't ever roll straight. We call them bananas. So every time you screen, you're not running in a straight, we don't open and roll either. We run roll, we sprint roll. So you're getting out and your first step's to the opposite corner. So if the ball handler is going to his left, coming off a screen to his left, the big screen, his left foot then is, if this is making sense, is going to the corner first to create a wider roll path to make that check have to cover the show, have to cover more ground between the guard ball handler and the big. Because we feel like if you go narrow, you open and roll, that big can show and get back quicker. So we want to create as much, and we try to get up 5 to 7, hopefully up to that 8 9 feet between the two. And that's why we catch so many lobs because that big can show and he's trying to recover. But if we can throw it high enough, there's just no way he can get all the way back in time. So that's one thing that we drill on a daily basis is the width of the roll and how fast they get out of the roll. We rarely make a hit. I don't ever need you to hit the guard. You just need to make sure the guard's on his hip. He has to go over the screen. So you're angled to make him go over. As soon as he's over the screen, get out, start running, run to the rim, and you're now a cutter. We're not really a pick and roll type of traditional style.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know, the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable, and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group Membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Talk to us about, because you're playing transition, you're trying to score fast. If not, obviously you're triggering something. And then let's talk about when that trigger doesn't work. Talk to us about re-triggering, which is a key part of playing conceptually like you're trying to do.
Yep. And I think that's the second part we get into is scout. So as soon as our action doesn't happen, let's say we're down to about 20, usually if we're 3 seconds in, we're into the second trigger. If that doesn't work, we're down to about 21 on the clock. So we got plenty of time to still make a play. Then what we really try to do is, what's the scout? Who's the scout? Who's the guy on the other team that we're really looking to try to attack? And then that guy should know it at that point. And you're going to sprint into an action and we're going to go a two-man game then with whoever has the ball with that defender and get that defender in some action and make some decisions. Whether it's a guy that struggles communicating, whether it's the big, if he struggles with screen and roll coverage, whether it's a guard that just has a hard time guarding the ball or someone that can't guard a shooter, whatever it is, we scout that and then you just got to try to get a small advantage. And then we just grow that advantage by our spacing, simple passes, simple equals great usually. And we just hammer home. We don't need to settle, because what we imagine, if we can get the ball out of bounds, get into a first trigger, get into a second trigger and not get anything, and that take 9 seconds, there's no reason to panic. If we got 20 on the shot clock. We've even talked about if there's 6 or 7 on the shot clock, that's 3 more paint touches. What's the rush? We should be able to move that thing and continue to attack. And you would assume, hopefully, that somebody makes a play and gets to the paint, gets 2 feet down, and the help has to come or whatever. If you got some good players, you'd assume that you can get something in that amount of time. And that's where we call it 0 second decision making. That's a big staple of our program. When you catch it, you got no time. It's either shoot it or go. And go could be a stampede catch, a shot fake and go. We don't jab and go. That's taking too long. The gap's already there. Plus one pass. So if you catch it and the extra pass is there, throw it as fast as you can. We're trying to take thought process out of the decision making, if that makes any sense at all. And we're trying to make it so simplified where if you're open, let it rip. If you're not, then there's no hesitation to attack type of thing. And then we say, see a chest and move it. The defender helps at all. These numbers commit to you. That means get off of it. Kind of like you said with the screen on roll, as soon as you're stopped, we try not to dribble, and that's where turnovers happen. So that's a big focus for us as well.
I love that. See the chest, move it, that draw to move it. But yep, again, I've been asking coaches, because obviously it's such a big part of the game, is what is actually the cue? And I love that you give your players more depth to that. And again, it does sound simple to me and to most people that understand conceptually how you're trying to play, but right. The terminology gives it power, doesn't it?
Yeah. You want to make them understand it with simplifying it. I always use the example, if there's a set and there's 50 different movements, 50 different screens, tons of sprinting around, it might work. And people do this and it does work. But you're also making pretty much everything nullified until that last action that happens. We want to make every single thing that happens throughout our triggers, our sprinting the court, every part of it and every person be a threat of some sort, just to keep the defense on their heels. And so making sure they understand some of those smallest things, as simple as the screening angle when the ball's in the slot compared to the top of the key compared to the wing. The big has to understand why, where, and what's happening, and just so they can try to thrive in it. And then once they figure that out, then they start to learn those things. But sometimes I think those small things are hard to coach because they seem so small, but making them understand it. And sometimes you got to keep it light, but sometimes you got to hammer it home until they get it type of thing. Teams do it all the time on defense. I think sometimes that's just offense. People would rather just run a play and get the ball to their best player at the end of the play. And we're just a little bit different the way we think about it.
You are, and you've been successful doing it, which is another part of it. And talk to us about what practice looks like, particularly scoring drills in practice and emphasizing these things.
Yeah, so we start with breakdown stuff. So let's say we're struggling with our screen and roll guard to guard stuff. We'll do breakdowns of that, working on the footwork of it, the angles, the passing angles we want, whether it's cutting, baseline cutting, wing cutting, 45 cutting, whatever it is, whatever the thing that we see we're just struggling with, we break that down to a very basic so they can understand it. That's also where I let my assistants do all the coaching, give them some power to understand, study their own film, relate and connect with the players individually rather than just me running all the drills. So then they have more conceptual understanding of the offense and what they're trying to get out of it too. I found a ton of success with that, with guys really that exciting them. Coaches want to, they get to coach and get to understand it as well. And then we move into a small sided game type of thing. Maybe there's a trigger that is, we're going to really hunt against a certain opponent based on maybe they switch off ball, they don't switch off ball. whether it's a ball screen in the middle, whatever we feel like we could attack, we'll small side game that to really hammer home those reads. And then we play. And everything we do, we play, we score. Some teams, it's been different. For the most part, green shots for points is that's just a staple for me. Some teams, if we struggle with simple decisions, we'll minus one or minus two for turnovers to make them really emphasize. You got to make the simple ones. And then they find out that's a couple simples in a row usually lead to something good. And then we do a lot of O rebounding, defensive rebounding, scoring, depending on the team. Do you struggle to rebound? Do you not? I think anytime you can use scoring in practice to create a small point of emphasis, that's really the only goal. I tell people if you have to score practice for teams to compete, you have an internal problem. You got to figure out, is it the kids? Is it you? Is it what is the situation where if you have to score it where they try, that's a red flag. You got to address that somehow else. The scoring should be points of emphasis, making them think about certain things that are point that are important to your program and what you're hunting. Patino used to always say that whatever you emphasize is what you're going to be. This is a great way to say it. So if you want to be the best offensive rebounding team in the country, then give 10 points for every offensive rebound in practice. Your guys will go do it then. And then winning the drill obviously can be a bonus. We don't even run for it. I don't half the time I don't even know what the score is. If I got to coach effort, we got other issues. We're not going to win many games. But scoring practice for us is just, all right, what do we got to focus on this week? What are we struggling with? How do we score to make them think about it? That's kind of the way we break it down.
I couldn't agree more. Like I just find I don't have to coach effort very often. And I
Right.
think that's a symptom of a little bit of the environment you're creating, but also the type of people that you're recruiting. But even at the youth level, like kids generally are there because they want to get better. So if you create an environment for them to get better, they're going to love being there and you don't have to coach
And
effort.
I think the best thing you can do for a young guy, high school, college, youth, is when they come in, your best players have to be that way. Your older players have to be that way. So then you'll stick out if you don't. And that took us a while to get to here. And that's understandable when you're building a program. Now, if you come in and you don't try, like you're going to stick out. If you don't communicate, you're going to stick out. If you're late to things, you stick out because you're the oddball. And so anytime you can hold kids to those standards, I think that really helps your program as well, too, because on a Friday night against another college team, if you're worrying about stuff that has nothing to do with basketball, you have no chance because everybody's good. I coached Division III before this, and those dudes can play too. I don't think there's any way to put it other than if you're not 100% focused on the scout and the game, you're going to lose. And so creating that atmosphere within your program where whether you want to do it or not, it's time to do it, and you give it everything you got while you do it. And that's just the standard you hold guys to. Because then if you put a small nuance into your offense, and we start to see this correlation, if I put something really small in, it might seem really detail-oriented, not a big deal, but they understand that whatever we do here, we just go as hard as we can and we do it as best we can, then that detail will work. If they look at the detail and take it the in kind of out approach, then those details aren't going to work, and then you all of a sudden have a disconnect. And so pairing all those things together, they go together. And that's been something that we really focus on as well too. The details make the big stuff happen. And so we really try to hammer home those small things first and then make sure in film sessions they understand, hey, see that screening angle? That's why you got the shot. Or hey, see that 45 cut? Remember how you're supposed to wait? That worked because you waited this time. You didn't run into our driver type of thing. Those type of things that you can really push to guys to understand the success came from the detail, not from just being athletic or making the shot.
Love that. And it may seem like a bit of a contradiction, but I understand exactly what you're saying. Look, we have scoring systems to emphasize things, but they shouldn't be doing things just to achieve the scoring system and game the scoring system because these are things that actually help them play their best basketball and help the team succeed. Talk about that balance. Do you ever remove the scoring system sometimes?
Oh yeah, we had a year where we really shot the ball well when from three when the ball came from the paint. We struggled with perimeter pass threes, which some teams are like that and some aren't. And we really struggled. And so I started saying, fine, paint touch threes are worth double. So if you hit a paint touch three, we're getting 6 points for this in practice to win drills. We'd have guys turned down breakaways. We'd have guys turn down layups just to try to get those 6 point shots. And I'm like, okay, we're not grasping. And I think this is another thing, my advice to coaches and from myself, I learned it the hard way is you have to adapt. If you think you know it all and just got it figured out, every team you have every year is different. And so trying to figure out a way to reach them, I always tell my assistants, if it's not working, don't tell them the same thing. Figure out a different way to tell them. Figure out a different way to coach it to them. If they're not understanding what a stampede catch is and why aren't they doing it well, don't bl keep blaming them. blame yourself. Figure out, okay, how can I teach it differently where maybe it'll connect, it'll click. Instead of, I had a team a couple of years ago where the group film just didn't work. It just didn't. So we started doing it in positions and it started to click because they could just focus on what they were supposed to do. They weren't hearing the other stuff about the guards, if you're the bigs, et cetera. And just really trying to find ways to get guys to understand without, too many times coaches get stuck in their way, and I'm guilty of that. And I'm sure every coach you talk to is like, yeah, man, I've been doing it the same way forever, and this is how I've always done it. At the same time, if the team doesn't connect with it, you've got to change it up. And scoring in practice is a simple way to catch yourself with, this worked last year. Guess what? The team this year is not last year's team. And so you got to do things differently. And this is, again, where I think high school coaching is, I'm most impressed by the high school coaches that win every year, because they win with a different roster, with a different star player in a different position nearly every year. So the guys that continue to do it, those guys, I'm fascinated by those people. I get to recruit. I get to recruit the type of players that fit my style and what I like. These guys get the hand they're dealt. And the guys that can win and get guys to defend and play basketball in their system, those are the people I watch that in the NBA. Those are the two that I love to watch and figure out how they make their teams buy into their systems and what they do.
That makes sense. Absolutely. And you mentioned offensive rebounds. So shape that a little bit. How many are we sending to the boards? What's the emphasis in terms of that? And obviously that goes in line with your philosophy, which is obviously pace and be aggressive and let's score. That's the goal.
Yeah, it's crash or tag. I hate no man's land, just like in defense. I don't want anybody stuck in the middle. Either go help or don't. Don't be the guy standing in the middle, creating passing lanes and opportunities. So on offense, if that shot goes up, you're either a crash, so go get it, or tag, which means go get your guy and eliminate transition baskets. I'm not a two guys back, three guys crash. I'm not a you crash every single time. It's because I think some of it's a read. If you're on the ball side wing and the shot goes from the corner, it doesn't make a ton of sense for you analytically for you to run in and crash, because the ball 80% of the time is going to go to the opposite side of the court. So you might get a tip or something, but you could run in and tag and then maybe get the tip. And so trying to teach those reads with that, I think that's part of your offense. And at the same time, when you're playing fast, a lot of times you're in transition and the box outs aren't as great. So we want guys to see crashing glass as an opportunity more than a chore, because early in possessions, transition defense, every coach harps it, like, yeah, transition, you got to find a body and go box it out. It's not your guy. We don't have enough players. You got to rotate and rebound. Well, in our system, that should fit almost every possession if we're doing it right, where they should be in a little bit of a scramble, which should give us lanes and opportunities to go get offensive rebounds and easy points. And most NBA analytics stuff I've seen is all rebounds, pretty high points per possession. 3-point shots off all rebounds, pretty high points per possession. And there's nothing worse than when the other team gets an all rebound and they get an and one. No, nothing makes everybody else more mad. So the more of those we can get, the better. And I'll take simple points like that too. And just, again, making guys buy into something that might not make sense to them right away. And that shows growth within the program as well.
I think sometimes on the podcast, certainly for maybe newer coaches or younger coaches, we portray a lot of this stuff as being easy, right? Play fast. It's easy.
Right.
But it's not easy. Talk to us about that a little bit. Some of the processes that you go through to be able to get your players playing fast and some of the challenges.
Yeah, I think, and I'll be blunt with this. When coaches tell me they want to play, and I'll talk to anybody that ever wants to talk about it. Everybody's welcome to our practices at any time. And we have coaches come in our first couple of practices of the year all the time. And I hear the same thing all the time is, how do you wait this out? Because at the beginning, shots are terrible. We're turning it over. Our actions are bad. Our triggers aren't running smooth. And you have to wait. You have to let it ride through the ups and downs. And I think sometimes that's really difficult for coaches, because coaches, and I've been guilty of this as well, you want the power. You want the control of your team, of your offense, who shoots it, what type of shots you're getting. And we really have, you have to weather through the storm, per se, of the early season. First of all, they're out of shape, so they're going to miss. I think the first week of practice, we shot like 19% from three. And we sat in the office like, I wonder if we're going to make any threes this year. Hopefully. Now we're shooting close to 40. We're doing just fine. But early in the year, they don't have legs. They're tired. The passes are bad. They're late. We're not filling the corners. So all the angles are more difficult. All those little things just take time. And so if you're not running a set, there's randomness to it. And so it's like a football thing, whereas if everybody doesn't do their job, it's not going to continue to work yet. And so harping that all five guys have to do their job on every possession and the most difficult part to playing fast is you might not shoot it for five possessions in a row because I'm not controlling who gets it. Whereas on if you play on a different team, they might run plays for three players and those guys know they're going to get their touches and their plays. For me, there's so much randomness to it. You have to be okay with being missed. You have to okay with not getting looks for a little bit, and then all of a sudden the streak will happen where you'll get three looks in a row. And so I think that's the most difficult part to playing fast is the randomness to it, the lack of control, especially early, and weathering the turnovers, the bad shooting, the bad execution. And then one thing we found is hard to get ready to play defense because we can work on our defense every day against ourselves, and then we don't see that all year long. We guard different stuff. So that's another challenge with it too, to really split your practice in half, which is something that I adapted about 2.5 years ago, where half the practice is focused on our defensive system and then half shifts to offense because at the end of the day, we can't guard ourselves because this is not reality on what we're going to see. And we'd be dumb to continue to guard ourselves. And then all of a sudden we play somebody that first week and it's nothing like we've seen all fall. So that's been something that we've been focused on the last couple of years to get better at that too. So playing fast is fun once you get to the product, but you just got to get there and it takes a while.
So talk to us about dividing practice up. So mostly what you're doing is two-way teaching or two-way playing, but one side is emphasized over the other is what you're saying?
Yep. So, really, to make it simple for them, when we play defense, we don't leave the half court. We do everything small-sided. It depends on the system. Some years we've switched, some years we haven't. You're working 1-2 on the same side. You're working on transition defense. You're doing different things that are all half court for us. And then we'll run certain actions every day for the offense. And then we play cutthroat pretty much after you install all the basic rotations and the shell stuff. But then after that, it's one day we might do the offense is running zoom actions. A common play right now in basketball is the high post entry, top of the key entry, and then down screens into handoffs. Very common play that we're going to see throughout the year. So we'll guard zoom for the whole day. That'll be the whole defensive day. And then the next day might be horns. And then the next day it might be a screen to screener or dribble weave or whatever. And what we've done in the past is we've studied through our league. We make a list of all the different actions that we see the most of, chart them out, how many. Do we see horns 50 times and then we see zoom 40 times? Okay, then we'll do 2 days of horns and we'll do 2 days of zoom and so on, all the way down the list of all the different actions. So then our defense is just getting a different look. And then we have an offensive coach through that as well, because even though we're running those plays, we can still hunt green is the mindset that we do. It's not just free for all, just get out there and chuck it. So a little bit of both, but we slow it down, get in the half court, because our ball screen coverage has to be able to work the ball screens we're going to see too. Not people do a lot of the ball screens that we do, which is different too. So that's kind of how we split practice right in half. And then we do free throws. So that's almost like a mental shift. We go to free throws 5 minutes. They bring their water, shoot two and rotate. And then as soon as that 5 minute buzzer goes off, they know, all right, now we're switching to offense. And they got to ramp up a little bit.
So, ball screen, I want to go back to that a little bit because I know it's such an important part. And watching the film again, you'll see a lot of this coaches. Talk to us about screening angles and particularly like how you're teaching that. That's such a big part of kind of modern basketball is having the correct angles.
Yeah, and in college basketball, the moving screen is prevalent. It's a very big call. It happens a lot.
They're
So we
not
drill
calling
it
the
every single.
charge anymore, so they have to call something that looks good.
Exactly. The offense has to get called for something. So we do a ton of timing. When the big's supposed to pop their feet, where the guard has to be, what hand the ball has to be in for the guard to set up a, we call it a go route, which would be a refusal. A lot of people call it a refusal. We call it setting up the ball screen. So the big can tell the timing based on the bounce of the ball. It's a whole process that we've built into it. And then where it happens. So the more the ball gets centered, the flatter the screen is, if that makes sense. So as the ball moves towards the center of the court, the flatter the hips of the screener is sending the guard to the rim. So we want their tailbone to face the rim pretty much. If you move to the wing, you're a little more tailored. Your tailbone's a little more towards, it's a little more angled because you're on the sideline. And then we always talk about the depth of the screen. So where are we aiming? What are we aiming for? And so like up the sideline, they need to aim about 2 feet lower than the actual defender. And the guard should be setting up and using that screen, setting up the refusal. And then because the guard has to go over, that's the goal. And then the other part to that is your the guard coming off. This is where our we call them our KGs. We don't call them fives because Kevin Garnett's my favorite player of all time. So I had to name him something. But when they screen, you have to also recognize what is the guard? who is the guard? Is the guard a shooter? Because then they're going to go over no matter what. Then you got a little leniency. But if he's a non-shooter, your angle's got to be even deeper. So we always talk about when guys sub in the game, what screening angle are we in? Where are we at? The depth of it. So they understand and make sure that we're getting that guard to go over the top because we've got to get that advantage. And I think the best way to put it is make them go 2-on-2 and learn to screen consistently so that it's almost like a relationship, like a quarterback and a wide receiver. And so by the end of the year, they just know when the guy's going to come off, when he's going to explode off of it, and when the big needs to be set. And they just have to understand and grasp that timing of it. And we never walk. So if the big's ahead of the play, he needs to get down to the nail, and then he needs to meet the defender at his pickup point. So you're sprinting out into it. And we use about a 2 to 3 foot window for the screen for the feet to pop to make sure we don't get the moving screen. And that's a big focus as well, too. So you're sprinting up, creating separation with the big, which then also allows that cut back by the guard if he has that window to cut back. But then that avoids the moving screen by sprinting away, popping the feet 2 to 3 feet short, and then the depth of the screen. Are you low, high? Where is the screen happening? Is it on the wing? Is it way out at a half court? That's going to change your angle as well, too. And so we show that on film and we do a drill with it. It's almost like a warm-up drill almost every single day with the point guard and the big. And then they go with a different guard every day. So they really work on understanding the timing of it, the angles of it, and then the execution of it. And then that first step as well, too, that we talk about, which is very unique, which is we get some transfers and they're like, whoa, what are we doing on this screen and roll? I've never done this. And we call it screen and run instead of screen and roll.
Love that, and love that connection to obviously screening angles and the depth of thinking and depth of understanding. It's just beautiful, like how much better we've got at teaching so many things in the game, haven't we, over the years?
Yeah, it's stuff like this. One of my favorite, I've heard coaches on here that I've known for a long time. I've known Sundance for a long time. We were in the same conference together. And I learned stuff from him that he could have just told me on the phone a long time ago. But instead, I'm listening to the podcast and we're learning stuff from each other on here. And I feel like there's transparency now that is new and it's okay now. People share their ideas and people are growing from it. And I think that's why basketball has gotten so good. The different concepts and play, the player development and the stuff that's grown is it's insane how good players and teams are nowadays. It's fun to see.
Absolutely. Like Sundance and so many coaches come on here. And I think it's just so authentic that they want to share. And you're doing that now, coach. And we really appreciate that. And it's got to get you jazzed up because you're going to get a lot of people reaching out, just like you mentioned to me personally, that at clinics, you get so many people excited and reaching out. And it's a lot of fun to be able to coach and create a community around you, around the things that you're doing.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite parts is no matter what level I'm coaching at, I was at Division III and now I'm in Division II. I could be here the rest of my life. I want any coach to feel like they can come to me with anything at any time. We're all a community. We're trying to help each other because I've been in the shoes. I've been in the shoes of the first year assistant, the volunteer assistant, the head assistant. I've been in all those shoes as well too, so I know how difficult it is, and I want to make sure that we can help as many people. And I get excited about my system. It's a fun way to coach and play, and I think my guys really love it. And anybody that wants to try to do it, I'd love to help the best I can.
Love that, and super appreciate you sharing with us. And coaches, you're going to listen to this podcast. If you listen to the audio, then make sure you go to our YouTube channel, Basketball Immersion YouTube channel, and Coach Fletcher is going to share and do a little bit deeper dive with some plays and different things that they do conceptually to be able to show us kind of the visuals of this. So appreciate you doing this and appreciate you doing that, coach. Thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on. I had a lot of fun.